Bridge is your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. What is to be done? Responding to the crisis of capitalism.
Well, if you're feeling dizzy from the whirlwind events on Wall Street, while capitalism's balloon bursts, we won't deflate. But what should we make out of the dire pronouncements? What is to be done? We bring you highlights now of an emergency forum of leading left voices on economics and grassroots politics at the Brecht Forum, co-sponsored by The Nation magazine.
Now, Arun Gupta, journalist and activist focusing on searing commentary on U.S. economic structure, Francis Fox Piven, one of America's most thoughtful and provocative commentators on America's social welfare policy. We begin with William Grider, journalist and author, persistently challenging mainstream thinking on economics.
We're in a very rare moment of history where a dynamic has taken hold that changes everything, that breaks all of the ideological barriers and practical political barriers, and is a serious crisis for the nation and also the world, but it's also a liberating moment. You can see it for yourselves just watching the newspapers every day. When Paulson put on the table his very arrogant proposal to bail out his colleagues in the Wall Street Club and literally said, take it or leave it, this is what we need to stop this crisis. And Congress choked a little bit, but basically caved, particularly the Democratic Party, without questioning for a moment whether it made any sense or whether it would work or what the equities were. And they passed it on a Friday, and on Monday, the stock markets of the world just blew it away. All of the editorials and the hand-wringing invested in Paulson's genius suddenly disappeared. We ain't hit bottom, and that's terrible, and heard from more than a couple of people who really literally are losing their retirement savings, and their lives are going to change very dramatically. But our perception should be this is a rare opening. The old order is crumbling. The politics right now is the fight of the old order, represented not just by Wall Street, but by other interests, to cling to their diminishing power. And up to now, they have been assisted and supported in that by both political parties and most responsibles, so-called. But that, too, is changing rapidly. That's the dynamic we're in. So you have to now put aside the reflexive despair that people on the left usually experience, even about the election outcome and our new president, whom I think we all hope is the same person, and look at it as a dynamic process that we can influence, putting big ideas, fundamental reconceptions of American society and economy on the table as loudly as possible, and speak with a confidence that you're being rolled up now, but wait until next February. There's a beginning of a consciousness in at least some of the politicians that they're in that situation. They don't know what to do about it. They're sort of stumbling around. And what I'm saying is, this is the moment when we talk about the society we want to help create in the most ambitious term. And I'm not being a pie-eyed optimist. I understand all the reasons why that may well fail. But this is a moment of history people rarely, rarely get. And we've got it, and we should try to make the most of it.
We don't know how deep the financial crisis is. We don't know how much it will spread to what's called the real economy. We don't know whether the government interventions that presumably are designed to stabilize the financial markets will work. And we also don't know whether Wall Street is taking over government through those interventions or whether government is taking over Wall Street. And we aren't quite clear about whether the government interventions, the bailouts, simply mean more redistribution of American wealth upward and more scapegoating of the poor for the crisis. For example, the Community Reinvestment Act is blamed, mortgage lending to poor people is blamed for the collapse in the markets. Economic crisis, although it's tragic. I mean, a lot of people get hurt, and a lot of people in the United States get hurt, and they get hurt all the way down the sort of international economic food chain in Mexico and Africa and so on. So terrible things happen, but it also generates new political possibilities. Now, Whenever we say that, we're really thinking about the Great Depression, because the Great Depression generated a lot of economic real hardship, but that was combined with a virtual total discrediting of the economic ruling class. FDR railed against the economic royalists. We also got a Congress that hauled these people before congressional committees, machine gunned them with questions. It had a huge impact in the political culture of the country. For a 10, 15, 20 year moment, people were not in the grip of the ideas of the economic ruling class. Maybe something like that will happen now. It's already the case that the press, for example, and the Congress has moved away from the sort of idiotic worship of the Delphic statements of Alan Greenspan. Remember that? It wasn't that long ago. Now they're really angry about the terms of the bailout, for example. Did you read the story about the Chicago sheriff who said he wasn't going to evict anybody who defaulted on their mortgages? That's what happens. Everything is up for grabs. How do moments of economic crisis create the possibility of reform? Well, there is an election coming up. Barack Obama is bringing out lots of new voters, young voters, minority voters. But if we have a new president, that has got to be only the beginning of a period of transformation, not the end. It wasn't FDR winning in 1932 that led to significant economic, social, and political change in the country. FDR and his rhetoric created a climate which helped to encourage the great social movements of the 1930s, from the movement of the unemployed to the farmers' movements to the movement of the aged, and especially, of course, to the labor movement. Those movements created a lot of social disorder, but they also created a lot of instability. And because they did, FDR responded to the demands of the movement. Bill Grider said we should talk big. We should think about how to reorganize the economy. We should think about the end of empire, perhaps. And I think we should think about those things. But I don't think we should overlook the more homely reforms that people will respond to, like restoring unions in the United States, restoring the social welfare system in the United States, reversing the cutbacks, restructuring those programs. We don't want a national health system that gives everything to the providers. We want to rein in the providers in our national health care system. We want good income support systems, a decent retirement system, and we want to regulate the unregulated economy. If we really are in the middle of a new period of possibility, we should also be willing not only to think big, but to take it one step at a time, building the institutional arrangements that empower ordinary Americans and stand as walls restraining the next episode of market plunder if it comes.
We are in a severe economic crisis that requires dramatic action. The pathogen has jumped from the financial sector to the rest of the economy. And right now, the only institutions that can do anything about it is government. So there has to be some sort of concerted action, not just by the U.S., but now globally. And our role is to make sure that whatever policies are democratic, transparent, and accountable. Our work is largely done on an ideological level in terms of arguing for the necessity of, say, something like a Green New Deal or single-payer national health care, which are two proposals a lot of people are throwing out there. It's hard to argue against it when you have this massive intervention in the economy. This crisis might also end up doing what the anti-war movement hasn't been able to do, which is to bring about an end to the Iraq War. This crisis is the contradiction of 30 years of laissez-faire economics, that is neoliberalism. But without a mass-based dynamic opposition with a clear vision, agenda, and strategy, the neoliberal model will just reassert itself. And it is already reasserting itself. The Paulson Plan, it's essentially self-regulating, which is how we got into this mess in the first place. And also what we see especially scary at the local and state level, there's all this talk about selling off assets, like toll roads, lotteries. Our assets are going to be sold off to corporations for a quick infusion of cash to cover cover some budget shortfall. So without diverse economic structures, whatever regulatory frameworks are put in place will just be undermined and overturned down the road. There's a huge opening for left and anti-capitalists, and I don't think it's that hard to come up with a detailed programmatic proposals. What's much more difficult is organization and ideology. I've been in a lot of meetings and discussions in the last few weeks around organizing against the Wall Street bailout plan, and people don't want to confront the need for organization and the need to have a clear ideology, because once you do, it leads to political battles. Without having an ideology, something to counter the neoliberal ideology, we can't really say what we're for, we can't say who the agent of change is, we don't have anything to organize around. If there's one reason for this economic crisis, it is a slavish devotion to free market ideology. With this latest fiasco, the Treasury and Fed spent the last year assuring the public that the contagion had been quarantined, and then when the market started to melt down, haphazardly enacted half measures that deepened the crisis. You can see virtually every single day a new policy proposal. This crisis is just working its way through the regular economy. It is going to be severe. A lot of folks here are probably familiar with Nouriel Roubini, known as Dr. Doom, because he predicted this all a couple of years ago, an economist at NYU. His latest statement is, in the best case scenario, we're looking at a severe recession for 2 years. And of course, in the worst case, people are talking about depression, though there's no real agreement what constitutes a depression. But already we see car and retail sales are plummeting, tourism is evaporating, the tech sector is slumping, chain stores are going bust by the thousands, and job losses are accelerating. And the real world pain is just beginning as state and local governments cut back on services and government jobs, which will create another cycle of decline. Pensions are likely going to be cut. And then there's the larger impact on the third world and Brazil, Russia, India, and China. So we can talk about the solutions later, because I guess I have less time than a Wall Street bank. But the real key is not just demands, but organization and ideology.
I want to speak about particular reforms like a wealth tax. I don't think any of us know whether this is the end of capitalism. Moreover, I don't think we're ready for the end of capitalism. What are we imagining the end of capitalism is going to be like? Poofed socialism? No. The end of capitalism, the end of the empire, is going to be a very long, slow, harsh period. This is going to be like the fall of the Roman Empire. We have to be prepared for a very long time to do political work on projects that both make life a little bit better for lots of people and also move us in the direction of a new society at the same time. And we've got to be ready for tough work. It's very striking to me that we've said almost nothing about electoral politics while the overwhelming majority of the American people are up to their eyeballs in an electoral campaign. We have to pay more attention to the interplay between electoral politics and movements. If McCain and the Republican Party wins this election, it's going to be very dark times. Then we really do have to worry about it. For all of my life, people have always been saying, oh, fascism is coming. If McCain wins, it may be here. Then we'll really have to worry about repression. Then we'll really have to worry about wholesale plunder of the public sector. On the other hand, Obama could win. I understand that he's surrounded by lobbyists and by financial experts, but if Obama wins, he will be vulnerable to the constituencies that he's mobilized in the election, youth and minorities. And they are also movement constituencies. An Obama administration could take advantage of the fact that the right considered politically is imploding. You can't take advantage of that development. You need movements, but you also have to pay attention to the bearing of electoral politics on movements and movements on electoral politics.
Let me say a word for big ideas which are not going to wait upon socialism. The ingredients are present, and that's what I mean when people speak stepping up to this moment. The Federal Reserve, created in 1913 as financial capitalism's concession that the industrial society needed a central bank. They arranged that so that they would control the central bank. We got to the disastrous dereliction of the Federal Reserve in the New Deal, and out of that came good reforms. The Fed was supposed to take care of not just capital, but labor and the society more broadly. The last 25 years, really starting with Volcker and expanded outrageously with Greenspan, the Federal Reserve quite deliberately tipped the balance to capital, financial institutions, and punished labor. That's not the only explanation, but it's central to why industrial average wages have been flat for 30 years. Globalization is alongside of it. Simultaneously, Greenspan dismantled the regulatory oversight of the financial institutions. These two consequences together core to understanding what is happening now in the financial crisis. Now, we have a visible record of the central bank, not just dereliction, but its profound bias on display with real consequences for real people. That is the basis for a very aggressive politics that says enough. This deal that was made with the Morgan banks in 1913 is kaput. And you could sell that in any small town in America, not to mention a few labor halls. This is a moment, certainly with the next president, where one of the things we put in front of him is you must change the nature of this relationship or American capitalism will always produce these results. Let's start having the argument. First of all, you would tear up the charter that was written in 1913, which most of which was fictitious, the idea that it was independent. What they created, and talk about deliberate plans, we'll create this technocratic institution that stands off aloof from politics and insulated from politics, and it will make these decisions as wise technocrats do, moderating everybody's demands, labor and capital, while all the time, of course. Wall Street was never separated from the Fed. The ethos of the Fed has to be smashed if you really want to change the relationships in the American economy. Yeah. They're getting closer to the basic solution, which they could have done 9 months ago. It would have been shocking, but not as shocking as watching the Dow Jones over the last 2 weeks. The government step up under its emergency powers, including regulatory laws, including the Fed's very ambivalently written powers to do whatever it needs to do in emergencies, should have stepped up and taken control of the entire financial banking system and said, we are going to keep you afloat and we're going to go through your books, and those that are sure losers, euthanasia, those who aren't, we'll inject capital, we'll do whatever we have to do. We will make sure you keep lending, because if you don't keep lending, we're going to turn off the water. The reason they didn't do that is that the sector of finance doesn't want that. They want the money, but not anything in return. They will do, out of natural self-interest, opportunistic things which actually hurt the system, make it harder to stop the crisis, but they think keep them alive. That's the process that turned the crash of 29 into a historic disaster, because everybody acted out of their own narrow self-interest, and that made it worse. I would lay alongside that another big idea. Anybody in this society who is ready and willing to work will have a job. And if the private sector won't provide jobs at livable wages, the government will. Full employment will provide a permanent stabilization under the labor markets. Once you do that, you have changed monetary policy and fiscal policy. When we go into a recession, most Americans will tolerate it because the pain flows downhill. The worst get hurt the most and first, and then it works up from there. We're going to go through that. It's going to rise before it stops this time, so most Americans are not going to be excused from the pain. My point is, once the government is accepted that when that happens to people at the bottom, the cost of their displacement will be shared by all taxpayers.
We're kind of dancing around the organizing issues. I'm not sure how exactly one organizes against repression. What you can do is kind of immunize yourself as a movement. You have to have a mass-based movement. You don't want to isolate yourself. This is really the most difficult issue. When these Wall Street protests happened, I was invited to take part in all these conference calls with a lot of the big liberal groups, like Move On, True Majority, Progressive, Democrats of America, etc. Man, they were the definition of spineless liberals. Who couldn't imagine that there's any power in organized protest activity just looking to the Democratic Party. Yet the unfortunate reality is we need them. We have to figure out how we can inject ourselves into those movements. That's what will immunize us against the mass repression. You need a broad base of allies, because the minute you do have any success, you're going to have massive government repression coming down upon you. And the thing to me that was kind of interesting about the Wall Street protests is, since the anti-globalization movement sprang up in 1999, that was a product of years of organizing. But since then, we've seen movements come and go against the Iraq war, around the immigration movement. One of the great contradictions in the anti-globalization movement is that there was this idea that if you just get hundreds of thousands of people going marching around some big institution, they were going to bring its walls crumbling down. And if we just kept doing that, that eventually we would bring down global capitalism. And it's because there was no strategic thinking. There is no substitute for theory. And we need to build those types of organized ideological movements, or none of this matters. We can talk about anything we like about redistribution. It's not going to happen. I mean, I like bad Hollywood science fiction, and I see the future more like we're going to be in some sort of work camps churning the protesters into Soylent Green. That's the only type of public works that we're going to get out of this model. They're not going to give us anything. We have to fight for it. I just hope it doesn't take two centuries, like Fran implied with the fall of the Roman Empire, because I don't want to see us getting sacked by Goths and Visigoths again and again.
I just want to make two other remarks about wealth and redistribution. There is a wealth tax. It's not on financial capital. It's on real property. If you go across America and talk to real folks, that's the thing that drives them crazy, but in fact does choke them, because it rises as local governments get into financial trouble. Groups of the left could begin talking to that broad America that is now regarded widely by lefties as unapproachable. You go out and you talk about wealth tax in their terms, and I guarantee you, you could start a pretty lively argument and explain you're paying a wealth tax. It's these other guys who don't get one, and whenever you bring it up, everybody says it's confiscatory. Well, maybe the property tax is confiscatory. On the redistribution of income, if we're not for massive redistribution of income, I don't know what else you got to say to the American people. And of course that's the tax code. The holes in the tax code, which are not accidental, they're quite deliberate. We're going to change the whole lexicon of taxation. And capital gains, we'll say, look, we'd love to keep the capital gains low because we know you guys, that stimulates your juices. But we're going to return you to the status of what they used to call unearned income. Unearned income must be taxed at least as high as the income of work. You could take that argument out to America and talk to people who are now coming to the Palin rallies, and you would find agreement. I don't have any doubt of that. But I think, and it's not just the left, it's in general, the left of Newt Gingrich party, whatever that is, has not yet had the step-up nerve to say, hey, we can talk to that group. We understand what they're going through, and we will, about things like this.
In terms of what an actual strategy is, even though I describe myself as an anti-capitalist, I think for the moment it is a Keynesian strategy, because we need something to give time and space to the left. A quick anecdote. In 2004, a group of us who were organizing against the RNC were invited to take part in discussions with all these liberal groups. They were talking about how many people they were sending into the field to do organizing for Kerry, and now was like, oh, we're sending like 30 people. Anti-war groups are like, oh, we're sending 5 people. There were 2 representatives from the Central Labor Council, and when it was their turn to speak, they're like, well, SEIU is sending 2,500 full-time organizers into Ohio. We cannot compete with organized labor, so our role is not to lift a pinky finger for Obama. Of course, it would be better if he's elected, but our role is to create an independent, dynamic left that can put real political pressure and get real gains out of the electoral and political process.
I want to say a word about what people in movements do to actually exert power. It's not just that they have banners and slogans and ideas, and it's not just that they have marches and rallies. When people have real force, it's because They acted in ways which made the continuing function of major institutions impossible. In order to get things running again, to establish a minimum of order again, concessions had to be made. That's how labor won government protection for the right to organize. Workers were just sitting down in the factories, 18 sit-downs in 2 weeks in a General Motors factory. Nothing would work unless you paid attention to the demands of the people on the street, in the factories, in the schools. If we think about movements in terms of the leverage they have on the institutional relations which are at the core of the society, then we might have a debt movement that took the form of people refusing to leave their homes when their mortgages are foreclosed. I think there'd be a lot of sympathy for people who thought that they shouldn't be kicked out because those rotten lenders had fleeced them. There was a movement like that early in the Depression after FDR was elected. It was a rent strike movement, or before he was elected it began. People in Chicago marched through the streets of Chicago. Communists organized this, by the way. They marched through the streets of Chicago because they had heard that the bailiffs were moving the furniture out of somebody's apartment. They used their physical presence, their force, to prevent that eviction. There were fights. That kind of action led the mayors of several cities to put a halt to evictions. We have to go beyond talk, beyond big dreams. We want to have big dreams, but we want to have really tough, rough actions as well.
You were listening to William Greida, Arun Gupta, and Francis Fox Piven at an emergency forum on The Economy, put on by the Brecht Forum and The Nation magazine. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and we invite you to log on to our new website, www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
That's buildingbridgesradio.org.